This is the first CLE course based upon the monthly compilations of summaries of negligence-related decisions released by our New York Appellate Courts and posted weekly on the New York Appellate Digest website. I'm starting with the January 2019 compilation and will create separate CLEs for each succeeding month. The idea is to allow readers to keep up to date with the latest appellate decisions and simultaneously earn CLE credit. The page references in this podcast are to the January 2019 negligence pamphlet. In Matter of PS on page 6, a special needs student left school and attempted suicide. The student sued the school district, alleging negligence and negligent supervision, hiring, training, and retention. The school district argued that the student, who had an individualized education program pursuant to the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, known as the IDEA, was required to exhaust the remedies under the IDEA before turning to the courts. The Supreme Court agreed, but the Second Department reversed. Although there is broad language in the IDEA stating that the exhaustion of remedies provision applies to actions brought under the Constitution or under the Americans with Disabilities Act or other federal laws, there's no mention of common law negligence actions. Therefore, the Second Department held that the IDEA did not apply to this common law negligence suit. So the takeaway here, the IDEA does not apply to a negligence action against a school district brought by a student who has an individualized education program, also known as an IEP. In Romero on page 7, it's a freight elevator accident case. The heel of plaintiff's foot was caught between a floor landing and the moving elevator. The elevator didn't have a gate separating the cab from the elevator shaft. The defendants demonstrated that the elevator was in compliance with all rules, regulations, and codes, and Supreme Court granted defendants' motion for summary judgment. The Second Department reversed, finding there was a question of fact whether the absence of an interior gate was a dangerous condition, and the defendants were placed on notice of the dangerous condition by their own elevator service company. Compliance with codes, rules, and regulations then did not demonstrate the elevator was safe as a matter of law. So the takeaway is that compliance with all codes, rules, and regulations that does not necessarily demonstrate that a condition is not dangerous. The Atala case on pages 7 and 8, it's a legal malpractice action, demonstrates the importance of a retainer agreement. The Second Department held that the retainer agreement standing alone entitled the attorneys to dismissal of the complaint. The plaintiff hired the attorneys after he was expelled from the New York College of Osteopathic Medicine. As the court explained it, the letter of engagement provided, quote, "Our services will include all activities necessary and appropriate in our judgment to investigate and consider options that may be available to urge administrative reconsideration of your dismissal from the College of Osteopathic Medicine. This engagement does not, however, encompass any form of litigation or, to the extent ethically prohibited, the threat of litigation to resolve this matter. This engagement will end upon your readmittance to the college or upon determination by the attorneys working on this matter that no non-litigation mechanisms are available to assist you. The scope of this engagement may not be expanded orally or by conduct. It may only be expanded by a writing signed by our Director of Public Service." Again, that was a quotation from the retainer agreement, so the court went on. "An attorney may not be held liable for failing to act outside the scope of a retainer. Therefore, since the defendant's alleged failure to negotiate with the school, its alleged failure to commence litigation against the school, and its alleged failure to properly advise the plaintiff on the efficacy of a defamation action against non-school parties fell outside the scope of the party's letter of engagement. Dismissal of the cause of action alleging legal malpractice was therefore warranted. Again, the takeaway here, a retainer agreement outlining the scope of an attorney's role in a particular case will preclude a malpractice suit on issues outside the scope of that role. In Noble, on pages 8 and 9, this is a medical malpractice case, the Second Department reversed Supreme Court and held the defendant doctor's motion for summary judgment should have been granted because the plaintiff's expert didn't lay a foundation for an opinion on a topic outside of that expert's field of expertise. The complaint alleged plaintiff's decedent after knee surgery was not given the proper dosage of medicine to prevent the pulmonary embolism which caused death. As the court explained it, where a physician provides an opinion beyond his or her area of specialization, a foundation must be laid tending to support the reliability of the opinion rendered. Here, the plaintiff's expert, who specialized in forensic pathology, did not indicate that he had any specific training or expertise in orthopedic surgery or prophylactic anticoagulation treatment to prevent the deep vein thrombosis, and failed to set forth how he was or became familiar with the applicable standards of care in the specialized area of practice. So the takeaway, when an expert in a medical malpractice case offers an opinion in an area outside the expert's area of specialization, the absence of a foundation demonstrating the basis for the expert's familiarity with the relevant standards of care invalidates the opinion. In Danielle, on pages 9 and 10, another medical malpractice case, the Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, found that the defendant's motion to set aside the verdict should have been granted because the defense was not allowed to cross-examine plaintiff's experts about the possible negligence of non-party doctors who also treated the plaintiff. In addition, the Second Department held that plaintiff's experts should not have been allowed to offer opinion evidence about emergency medicine because they were not shown to be qualified in that field. The takeaway here, the defense in a medical malpractice case should be allowed to cross-examine plaintiff's expert about the possible negligence of non-party doctors who treated the plaintiff. And in a medical malpractice case, an expert should not be allowed to offer an opinion unless first shown to be qualified in the relevant fields of expertise. In Roberts, on pages 10 and 11, the action against a volunteer fire company was dismissed because the notice of claim wasn't served on the right party. The notice of claim was served on the Coleman's Hollow Volunteer Fire Company, but the proper party was the Coleman's Hollow Fire District No. 3. The court explained, a volunteer fire company is under the control of the fire district. The fire district was responsible for preventing and extinguishing fires within its jurisdiction and trained and supervised defendants' members. When defendants' members responded to the fire at plaintiff's house, they acted under the direction of the chief of the fire district. Because defendant and the fire district are separate entities and defendant does not exert control over its members, defendant cannot be held liable for the alleged negligence of its members. We reject plaintiff's contention that defendant and the fire district are so inextricably intertwined that timely service of the notice of claim upon defendant equates to timely service upon the fire district. Although defendant conducted an examination of plaintiff under General Municipal Law 50H, equitable estoppel does not preclude any claim that plaintiff failed to serve the notice of claim upon the right party. Even though defendant was not obligated to inform plaintiff that she failed to name the proper party, defendant did so as an affirmative defense in its answer. plaintiff contends that General Municipal Law 50E permits deeming the notice of claim served upon defendant as being timely served upon the fire district. We disagree. This savings provision is limited in scope to defects in the manner of serving the notice of claim on the correct party. Before any defects in service can be overlooked, service on the correct party must be accomplished in the first instance. So the takeaway here is be careful when suing municipal entities. Check all relevant statutes and code provisions to determine the correct entity. Failure to serve a notice of claim on the correct entity may be fatal, even where the incorrect entity answers and holds a 50H hearing. The incorrect entity is under no obligation to inform the plaintiff of the mistake. In Tominski, on page 11, this is a products liability case, the Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the circumstantial evidence that defendant, called Prime Source, was the supplier of the wire mesh which was alleged to have injured plaintiff, that evidence was not strong enough to survive a motion for summary judgment. The court explained, the identity of the manufacturer or supplier of a defective product may be established by circumstantial evidence. The circumstantial evidence of the identity of the manufacturer or the supplier of a defective product causing personal injury must establish that it is reasonably probable, not merely possible or evenly balanced, that the defendant was the source of the offending product. Speculative or conjectural evidence of the manufacturer's or supplier's identity is not enough. Plaintiff's attorney submitted an affirmation in which he stated that a representative from the retailer produced a sheet of paper on which she had written the names of two suppliers she claims had supplied the wire mesh. This affirmation was insufficient to raise a tribal issue of fact as to who the supplier was. Takeaway, in a products liability case, although the identity of a supplier or of a product which causes injury can be demonstrated by circumstantial evidence, the evidence must meet the reasonably probable standard and not merely the possible or evenly balanced standard. In Lando on page 12, a stairway slip and fall case, the First Department vacated the plaintiff's jury verdict of over $500,000 and ordered a new trial, finding that plaintiff's expert should not have been allowed to testify about defects in the handrail because the trial evidence didn't allege the handrail was a proximate cause of the fall. The First Department also held that the riser heights should not have been charged as an independent theory of liability. As the court explained it, defendant's argument that there was insufficient evidence adduced at trial to charge the jury on theories that either riser heights or the handrail were approximate cause of plaintiff's fall has merit. Although plaintiff testified that it was her usual habit to hold a handrail while descending stairs, her testimony was equivocal on whether she held the handrail that day. She testified that she didn't attempt to reach for a handrail at the time of her fall because the accident happened too fast. Nor did she provide any testimony connecting the handrail to her optical illusion theory. Plaintiff's expert should not have been allowed to testify that the handrail was a contributing cause of plaintiff's fall, and the jury should not have been charged on the question whether the handrail was too short. In addition, while the final step's size may have helped contribute to plaintiff's claim of optical illusion, the riser heights in the staircase should not have been charged as an independent theory of liability. The takeaway in this case, an expert may not offer an opinion at trial about the proximate cause of an accident unless there is trial evidence supporting that specific proximate cause. In Mitchell, on page 13, another slip and fall case, the Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff's motion to set aside the verdict should have been granted. As the court explained it, the plaintiff alleged she slipped on what she believed to be popcorn oil and fell at defendant's movie theater. The jury found that the defendant was negligent, but the negligence was not a substantial factor in causing plaintiff's injuries. Whereas here, the issues of negligence and proximate cause were inextricably interwoven, the jury's finding that the defendant was negligent, but that such negligence was not a substantial factor in causing the plaintiff's injuries, was not supported by a fair interpretation of the evidence. The plaintiff and her friend both testified that plaintiff slipped and fell on an oily substance on the floor, and the defendants didn't refute that testimony. So the takeaway, where negligence and proximate cause are inextricably intertwined, a verdict finding the defendant negligent, but also finding that negligence was not a proximate cause of the injury, will be set aside. In Perez on page 14, another slip and fall case, the First Department, reversing Supreme Court, found that the plaintiff's own deposition testimony demonstrated the wetness on the stairs could not have been present for more than an hour. Therefore, the defendant landlord had neither actual nor constructive notice of the condition, and the landlord's motion for summary judgment should have been granted. The court said, plaintiff's deposition testimony offered in support of defendant's motion established that the water condition didn't exist for a sufficient period of time to discover and remedy the problem. There was neither actual nor constructive notice of the wetness. Plaintiff testified she had no reason to believe that the stair was wet when she left her apartment at 5 p.m. and that she slipped on the stairs when she returned less than an hour later. Any wet condition was present for less than an hour and might have been there only minutes or seconds before plaintiff slipped on it. So the takeaway, in an interior stairway slip and fall case, where the evidence demonstrates the dangerous condition could not have existed for more than an hour, the defendant will be deemed not to have had notice of it as a matter of law. In Malik, on page 15, another slip and fall case, the First Department, again reversing Supreme Court, held the landowner was not entitled to summary judgment. The principal of the property owner, a company called 514 West, was also the principal of the tenant in the building, a company called Style, a taxi company. Independent contractors used a hose to wash the taxis. Water from the hose froze, and plaintiff allegedly slipped and fell on ice that was on the road. The First Department noted the close connection between 514 West and Style and found that 514 West did not establish it was an out-of-possession landlord and could not escape liability on that ground or on the ground that the tenant was responsible for the dangerous condition. The court wrote, 514 West, which owns the building adjacent to the roadway in which plaintiff slipped and fell on ice, failed to make a prima facie showing of its entitlement to summary judgment. For example, its principal, who was also the principal of the co-defendant taxi company housed at the building, admitted that there was a hose attached to the building, which the independent contractors who work for the taxi company would use to wash the cars. It is water from this hose which pooled in the street and then froze. The plaintiff allegedly slipped on that ice. It is a general rule that an abutting owner is liable if, by artificial means, water from the property is permitted to flow onto the public sidewalk where it freezes. 514 West asserts that Style operated the hose, not it, thus absolving it of liability. However, 514 West fails to establish it is an out-of-possession landlord, given the very close connection between 514 West and Style, which, again, have the same principle. It is not possible on this record to determine as a matter of law that 514 West is without liability as a landowner. So the takeaway, A landowner will be liable where water is permitted to flow from a hose on the property to the street where it freezes, causing plaintiff to slip and fall. And defendant property owner was not shown to be an out-of-possession landlord who could escape liability on the ground that the tenant was responsible for maintaining the property. In Agbo Sasa, on pages 16 and 17, another slip and fall case, the Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, found that the defendant city did not demonstrate it had relinquished control over the parking lot where plaintiff allegedly fell into an access pit. The access pit was exposed because a snow removal contractor pushed the cover off when plowing snow. The city had a license agreement with an athletic club called Fitmar, which required Fitmar to maintain the parking lot. Fitmar had hired the snow removal contractor. The city argued it was an out-of-possession landlord and the parking lot was solely Fitmar's responsibility. The Second Department held that the parking lot was subject to a license agreement, not a lease, and therefore the out-of-possession landlord doctrine didn't apply. The Second Department went on to find that the terms of the license agreement did not demonstrate as a matter of law that the city had relinquished control over the maintenance of the parking lot. So the takeaway, the city was not an out-of-possession landlord which could escape liability for a slip and fall in the city's parking lot. The city had issued a license, not a lease, to the party required to maintain the parking lot, and the city retained ultimate responsibility for the use and the condition of the parking lot. In Van Wageningen, on page 17, another slip and fall case, this time involving the requirement that a city receive written notice of the defect which caused the slip and fall before liability will attach. The Third Department held the city's motion for summary judgment was properly denied. Plaintiff's decedent fell from a paved trail into a gorge. There were questions of fact about whether the city had prior written notice of the broken sidewalk and railing in the area where the plaintiff fell. The court explained, plaintiff produced a police investigation report concluding that the decedent had fallen along a part of the trail with multiple defects, including broken pavement, a bent unsecured hand railing, and huge gap spaces in the sidewalk. Plaintiff also demonstrated that by the time of the fall, the Department of Public Works had received numerous written complaints about the condition of the trail. General complaints and the subsequent efforts of the department personnel to evaluate the condition of the trail did not obviate the need for prior written notice of the specific defects implicated in decedent's fall. That said, one of the written complaints was a January 2012 email forwarded to an assistant superintendent of public works that was probably shared with the superintendent of public works, which attached to the email is a map with photographs that appear to reference the defects in the area where decedent fell. So that email with the map and the photographs was deemed enough to raise a question of fact about whether the city had been notified of the specific defect that caused the injury. And the takeaway, where a city requires written notice of a defect which causes a slip and fall before it can be held liable, the notice must describe the specific defect at issue. General complaints are not enough. In Rambaran, on pages 17 and 18, another slip and fall case, the Second Department held defendant's motion to set aside the verdict should have been granted. The defect, a protruding bolt on a stairway, was deemed trivial and non-actionable. The court wrote, the plaintiff's evidence at trial, including her own testimony, the testimony of her expert engineer, as well as photographs identified and marked by the plaintiff showing the alleged defect as it existed at the time of the subject accident, accepting such evidence as true, and affording the plaintiff every favorable inference that may be properly drawn from the facts, the alleged defect was not actionable. Considering the appearance and dimensions of the protruding bolt, as well as its location on the side wall of the staircase, directly underneath a handrail and away from the walking surface of the stairway, the defect was trivial as a matter of law. Accordingly, the defendant's motion pursuant to CPLR 4401 for judgment as a matter of law dismissing the complaint should have been granted. So the takeaway, even after a trial and a plaintiff's verdict, an appellate court may find a defect trivial and non-actionable. In the Aminova case, on pages 18 and 19, it's a third-party assault case, the Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the personal injury and wrongful death action against the landlord should not have been dismissed. Plaintiff's decedent was delivering Meals on Wheels in the building owned by the New York City Housing Authority, the defendant, when he was assaulted, allegedly by an intruder who allegedly entered the building through a negligently maintained entrance. The court explained, landlords have a common law duty to take minimal precautions to protect tenants from foreseeable harm, including a third party's foreseeable criminal conduct. This duty extends to the guests of the tenant. A tenant or guest may recover damages only on the showing that the landlord's negligent conduct was a proximate cause of the injury. In premises security cases, the necessary causal link between a landlord's culpable failure to provide adequate security and a tenant's injuries resulting from a criminal attack in the building can be established only if the assailant gained access to the premises through a negligently maintained entrance. Since even a fully secured entrance would not keep out another tenant or someone allowed into the building by another tenant, plaintiff can recover only if the assailant was an intruder. So the takeaway, to hold a landlord responsible for an assault on the premises, the assault must be by an intruder, and the intruder must have gained entry due to the landlord's negligence. At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code, which should be entered on your attorney affirmation to prove that you listened to this CLE podcast. The verification code for this CLE is intruder. Again, the verification code for this CLE is intruder. In McKiernan, on page 19, another third-party assault case, the Second Department held defendant's motion for summary judgment on the negligence cause of action was properly granted, but the motion for summary judgment on the aiding and abetting assault cause of action should not have been granted. The action stemmed from a road rage incident. Defendant Mancuso was driving, and his college-age grandson Vaccaro was a passenger. The grandson got out of the car and hit plaintiff in the face. The court explained, Mancuso, that's the grandfather, established that he did not owe a duty to the plaintiff by virtue of the relationship he had with Vaccaro, his grandson. The fact that Mancuso could have exercised control over Vaccaro did not create a duty to do so. The mere fact that Vaccaro was a passenger in Mancuso's car did not create a duty on the part of Mancuso to control Vaccaro's conduct. To be liable for an assault under an aiding and abetting theory, a defendant must have committed some overt act, either by words or conduct, in furtherance of the assault. Here, the plaintiff raised a triable issue of fact as to whether Mancuso's actions preceding the assault constituted an overt act in furtherance of the assault. So the aiding and abetting assault theory should not have been dismissed against Mancuso. The takeaway, the grandfather did not have a duty to protect the plaintiff from an assault by his grandson, and a person who by words or conduct furthers an assault by another may be liable for aiding and abetting the assault. In Matter of Holbrook, on page 20, a toxic torts case against a municipality, the Third Department found Supreme Court properly granted petitioner's application to file late notices of claim against the village stemming from a hazardous substance called PFOA in the municipal water supply. Although the petitioners did not have an adequate excuse for the delay in filing the notices of claim, the village had timely knowledge of the facts underlying the claim, and the village was not prejudiced by the delay. The court explained, the village was well aware of the PFOA contamination in its water system. Also, the village was well aware the likelihood of increased PFOA levels in the blood of its residents and was well aware of the negative health consequences as a result. The village cannot plausibly claim that it had only a general awareness of the presence of PFOA. Accordingly, we conclude that Supreme Court properly found that the village had actual notice of all the essential facts underlying petitioner's claim. Further, there's been no demonstration of substantial prejudice to the village as a result of the delay in filing the late notices of claim. The takeaway: the absence of an excuse for not filing a timely notice of claim against a municipality may not be fatal where the municipality had timely notice of the precise nature of the claim and was not prejudiced. In the AI case, that's the initials AI, on page 21, it's another toxic tort case. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, found that questions of fact were raised about the landlords, and the landlord there was the New York City Housing Authority, the landlord's responsibility for lead poisoning of infant plaintiff AI. Successive blood tests revealed increasing lead levels as the child aged and a decrease after the apartment was repainted. The first issue the court dealt with was whether Local Law 1, this is a New York City law, which creates a presumption that the paint in the apartment contained more than 0.5% lead for buildings erected prior to January 1, 1960, applied. The certificate of occupancy for the building was issued in March 1961, but there was evidence the building was under construction in 1959. The statute was interpreted to mean when the apartment was painted, which was after January 1, 1960, so the statutory presumption didn't apply, but there still was a question of fact about the city's liability. As the court put it, here, AI's elevated blood level suggests a hazardous condition may have existed in the apartment during the relevant period. While there are other sources of lead poisoning, housing is a prime source. The circumstantial evidence of hazardous lead-based paint condition is also supported by the expert affidavits. So the takeaway, even where a plaintiff is not entitled to a New York City local law's presumption that a building had 0.5% lead paint based upon when the building was erected, a question of fact about the presence of lead in the building may be raised by proof of the levels of lead in plaintiff's blood before and after the apartment was painted. In Avasato, on page 22, a rear-end collision case involving the inadequacy of the damages award, the Second Department, reversing Supreme Court and granting a new trial, determined the motion to set aside the verdict should have been granted. The jury found that plaintiff suffered a permanent injury, but didn't award plaintiff with damages for future pain and suffering. The Second Department also found that the $12,500 verdict for past pain and suffering was too low. As the court explained it, a jury verdict should be set aside as contrary to the weight of the evidence only if the jury could not have reached the verdict by any fair interpretation of the evidence. Here, the Supreme Court should have granted the plaintiff's motion pursuant to CPLR 4404A to set aside the verdict on the issue of damages for past pain and suffering and future pain and suffering, as the verdict with respect to those damages was contrary to the weight of the evidence. The jury's determination that the plaintiff was not entitled to damages for future pain and suffering was inconsistent with the jury's finding that his injuries were permanent in nature and were caused by the accident. Furthermore, whereas the jury was presented with conflicting evidence and theories as to the cause of plaintiff's injuries, and the jury's award for past pain and suffering was inexplicably low, it appears that the verdict with respect to damages for past pain and suffering may have been the result of an impermissible compromise. So the takeaway, a jury's verdict, which finds the plaintiff was permanently injured, but which awards no damages for future pain and suffering, can be set aside. In Franco, on pages 22 and 23, it's another traffic accident case. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that plaintiff's motion for summary judgment should have been granted. Defendant's tow truck was left running and unattended when it moved backwards into plaintiff's car. The court explained, plaintiff established entitlement to judgment as a matter of law, where he was injured when defendant's tow truck was left unattended by its driver, defendant Millar, and rolled backwards into plaintiff's car, which was stopped behind the tow truck. When a driver fails to secure an unattended vehicle sufficiently to prevent it from starting to move on its own, the driver is negligent. In opposition, defendants did not raise a triable issue of fact as they failed to offer a non-negligent explanation for the collision. Defendants' speculation that even though Millar left the gear in park before exiting the tow truck, the gear must have slipped into reverse on its own due to some mechanical failure. That was insufficient to raise an issue of fact. Defendants presented no evidence of any type of mechanical failure or defect, and Millar was able to drive the truck back to the depot after the accident without incident. The takeaway, leaving an unattended vehicle which subsequently moves constitutes negligence in the absence of proof of a mechanical failure. In Vasquez Santos, on pages 23 and 24, another traffic accident case, this time it raised a discovery issue. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the motion to compel access by a third-party data mining company to plaintiff's devices, email accounts, and social media accounts to obtain photographs and other evidence of plaintiff engaging in physical activities should have been granted. The court explained, private social media information can be discoverable to the extent it contradicts or conflicts with a plaintiff's alleged restrictions, disabilities, and losses, and other claims. Here, plaintiff, who at one time was a semi-professional basketball player, claims that he has become disabled as a result of the automobile accident, such that he can no longer play basketball. Although plaintiff testified that pictures depicting him playing basketball, which were posted on social media after the accident, were in games played before the accident, defendant is entitled to discovery to rebut such claims and defend against plaintiff's claims of injury. So the takeaway, where there is an issue whether photographs posted on social media of plaintiff playing basketball or engaged in other physical activities were taken before or after the accident, the defense may be allowed to have the evidence examined by a data mining company. In Trotman, on page 24, it's a city bus accident case, Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, determined the city's motion to vacate the order compelling disclosure of the city bus driver's personnel file should have been granted. Plaintiff alleged she was injured when she fell on the city bus, The city acknowledged that the driver was acting within the scope of his employment when the accident happened. Therefore, the city's potential liability was based upon respondeat superior, and a negligent hiring and retention action was not viable. Therefore, the personnel records were not discoverable. As the court explained, generally, where an employee is acting within the scope of his or her employment, the employer is liable for the employee's negligence under a theory of respondeat superior, and a plaintiff may not proceed with a cause of action to recover damages for negligent hiring and retention. In light of the defendant's formal concession that the bus driver was acting within the scope of his employment when the accident occurred, the personnel records of the bus driver are not discoverable. Furthermore, the plaintiff failed to show any other basis to justify granting her request for the personnel records, as any prior acts of carelessness or incompetence of the defendant's employee would not be admissible at trial. Therefore, the additional discovery sought by the plaintiff is not relevant or reasonably calculated to lead to evidence relevant to the issue of the driver's negligence. The takeaway: where the employer of the allegedly negligent employee acknowledges the employee was acting within the scope of employment at the time of the accident, the plaintiff cannot sue under a negligent hiring theory and is not entitled to the employee's personnel records. In Ramirez, another traffic accident case involving employment law, the First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the relation back doctrine of CPLR 203F allowed plaintiff, name was Polanco, to serve a supplemental summons and complaint against the employer of defendant Elias Tejada, the driver of the car in which plaintiff's decedent was a passenger. The Elias Tejada car stalled on a bridge and was struck from behind. Plaintiff Polanco did not learn until after the action was started that Elias Tejada was paid by his employer, Fairway, to transport the other occupants of his car, all Fairway employees, to work. Polanco sought to add Fairway as a defendant under a respondeat superior theory, and the First Department held that he could do so. The court explained, the claims that Polanco seeks to assert against Fairway arise out of the same occurrence as alleged in the complaint against Elias Tejada and the other two defendant drivers. Under the doctrine of respondeat superior, an employer will be vicariously liable for the negligence of an employee committed while the employee is acting in the scope of his employment. Based on Elias Tejada's employer-employee relationship with Fairway, they are united in interest, because a judgment against one of them will affect the other. The Fairway defendants can, therefore, be charged as having notice of Polanco's potential claims against them based upon the claims asserted against Elias Tejada in the original summons and complaint. So the takeaway: the employer of a driver involved in a traffic accident and the driver acting within the scope of employment are united in interest. The relation back doctrine will therefore allow late service of a complaint against the employer. And the final case in this January 2019 negligence pamphlet, IBAR, on page 26, it's a products liability case stemming from a traffic accident in Virginia. The Second Department determined that the case against Ford, the manufacturer of the vehicle which rolled over, and Goodyear, the manufacturer of a tire which allegedly failed, could not be brought in New York. The plaintiffs alleged general jurisdiction over both companies based upon business done generally in New York and registration with the New York Department of State. The plaintiffs didn't allege long-arm jurisdiction. Neither the vehicle nor the tire was manufactured or purchased from the defendants in New York. The plaintiff had purchased the vehicle from a New York non-party and had used the vehicle in New York. The court explained, We consider on these appeals whether, following the United States Supreme Court decision in Daimler, which is at 571 U.S. 117, a foreign corporation may still be deemed to have consented to the general jurisdiction of New York courts by virtue of having registered to do business in New York and appointed a local agent for the service of process. We conclude that it may not. We agree with those courts that asserting jurisdiction over a foreign corporation based on mere registration and the accompanying appointment of an in-state agent by the foreign corporation without the express consent of the foreign corporation to general jurisdiction would be unacceptably grasping under Daimler. The Court of Appeals does not appear to have relied upon its consent by registration theory since International Shoe was decided. We think that this is a strong indicator that its rationale is confined to that era and that it no longer holds in the post-Daimler landscape. We conclude that a corporate defendant's registration to do business in New York and designation of the Secretary of State to accept service of process in New York does not constitute consent by the corporation to submit to the general jurisdiction of New York for causes of action that are unrelated to the corporation's affiliations with New York. So the takeaway: a foreign corporation's registration with the New York Secretary of State does not constitute consent to the general jurisdiction of New York courts. In a second decision in this same IBAR matter, which was issued on September 18, 2019, that decision is summarized at page 25 in the September 2019 negligence pamphlet. It's obviously not included here in the January 2019 pamphlet. But in that September decision, the Second Department held that plaintiff did not rebut Goodyear's argument that it didn't have significant affiliations with New York. Again, this is the September 18, 2019 decision. The court explained, while the ultimate burden of proof rests with the party asserting jurisdiction, the plaintiffs, in opposition to a motion to dismiss pursuant to CPLR 3211A8, need only make a prima facie showing that the defendant was subject to the personal jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. A court may exercise general jurisdiction over foreign corporations when their affiliations with the state are so continuous and systematic as to render them essentially at home in the forum state. Here, in opposition to Goodyear's motion, the plaintiff failed to make a prima facie showing that personal jurisdiction over Goodyear existed under CPLR 301. The plaintiff did not rebut the evidence submitted by Goodyear showing that Goodyear's affiliations with New York are not so continuous and systematic as to render it essentially at home here. The September 2019 decision that was just discussed, I just quoted from, didn't explain what the evidence was that Goodyear presented about its lack of connection to New York State, but it was briefly explained in the January 2019 decision that we just talked about. So I'm going to read that aspect of the January 2019 decision. In support of its motion, Goodyear submitted evidence that the subject tire was designed in Ohio, manufactured in Tennessee in 2002, and tested and inspected outside of New York. Goodyear asserted that it had no way of tracking the sale or ownership of a given tire over its service life, but could identify that the subject class of tire was sold as original equipment for certain Isuzu and Ford vehicles, and as a replacement tire. Goodyear additionally submitted evidence that it operated a chemical plant in New York, and that it was a member of a limited liability company which owned and operated a tire manufacturing plant in New York, but that neither plant manufactured the subject tire, and that Goodyear did not specifically direct advertising of the subject tire to New York residents. So that was Goodyear's argument to demonstrate that they did not have sufficient affiliation with New York to confer jurisdiction on the New York courts. And in this September 2019 decision, the court held that the plaintiff was not able to rebut that evidence, and therefore Goodyear's motion to dismiss the complaint on that ground should have been granted by Supreme Court. So that completes this CLE, which is based entirely on the negligence-related decisions which were released in January of 2019 and summarized on the website New York Appellate Digest and thereafter compiled in the January 19th negligence pamphlet.